Texas crosses a critical 1 million mark in COVID cases, and the governor sends help to Lubbock as hospitals reach capacity. The latest coming up today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. Other stories we're tracking: a post-election push to update voting machines in Texas's biggest county. What's wrong with the old ones? We'll follow the paper trail, or lack thereof. Also, the top vote getter in Texas history and what it says about the intersection of politics and how top judges get picked in Texas. He was a Texas sharecropper's son in a Jim Crow Navy. Now a super carrier will bear his name. 8 decades after his heroics at Pearl Harbor, Dory Miller gets his due. Those stories and more when the Texas Standard gets underway. Right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 12th day of November 2020. I'm David Brown. And if you've had occasion to travel by car between cities in Texas, you've likely at some point come across a billboard expressing gratitude to those on the front lines of the pandemic. The first responders and health professionals push to the limit as they try to help others make it through. It is unsurprising to see such warm and undoubtedly sincere public displays of appreciation across Texas. Residents of the Lone Star State have a certain reputation for showing such grace under pressure, but it is that same sense of grace, perhaps, that prevents some of those first-line responders from saying aloud what many must be thinking privately. To quote one pandemic caregiver speaking to a French newspaper as that continent undergoes another devastating wave of critical COVID cases, "We do not want applause. We want people to respect the instructions." Though such a reply may dispense with sentimentality, it speaks to a reality familiar to many doctors and nurses and hospital workers across Texas. As the Lone Star State crosses the frightening threshold of 1 million total cases of COVID, more than any other state, and if it were its own country as it once was, Texas would rank 10th worldwide in the total number of coronavirus infections. Healthcare professionals, little rested since the spring and pushed to the limit on resources, are having to face down their weariness and find ways to deal with a new wave of coronavirus infections and deaths in parts of Texas. One of those places is a city in northwest Texas, best known perhaps as the birthplace of Buddy Holly. Catherine Wells is the City of Lubbock's public health director, and she joins us now. Catherine, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
What is the state of COVID-19 case numbers and hospitalizations in Lubbock right now?
We've definitely seen an increase over the last month or so. We've had over 20,000 cases within the county of Lubbock, which is about a population of about 350,000 people.
Mortality rate, I've heard that 18,700 deaths statewide. Do you have any sense of that in and around Lubbock?
Yeah, we're unfortunately seeing 2 to 6 deaths a day, which is really significant in a town our size.
We understand that the governor is sending in resources to assist in Lubbock. Can you tell us about the situation at hospitals and what you need?
Yes, our hospitals are reaching capacity. We've been over that 15% mark now for at least 2 weeks, and they're bringing in what they're referring to as blue tents. It's what we're seeing also in El Paso. So they're setting up surge capacity outside both our major healthcare systems here in Lubbock.
So these would be outside structures, tents, literal tents?
Yeah, they're literal tents. It's to be able to hold the overflow capacity with the thought that we are going to be needing that within the next week or so.
What do you think is happening? Why are you seeing this? Are you calling it a surge, another wave? How are you thinking of it?
Yeah, I really see it kind of as our third wave. We had a lot of nursing home outbreaks early in April, and then we saw some spikes associated with bars reopening in June. And now we've really seen our largest surge since this September, October. Just more and more cases and really a high load of virus in the community. Lots of community spread.
What do you think is happening? I mean, you think about that time frame, and certainly colleges and public schools reopening, although it's my sense that we haven't seen a lot of COVID-19 cases in the schools per se. So how do you read what's happening?
I really see a lot of the cases associated with activities outside of the school building or outside of the college campus. It's when people are getting together in small groups or kind of backyard barbecues and they let their guard down. And that's really where we're seeing the spread.
What accounts for the fact that, and of course we should mention that Lubbock is a university town, you have Texas Tech, Lubbock Christian University. What accounts for the fact that the spread doesn't seem to be happening in the classroom, but in activities that are sort of outside of those places of learning?
I think when there's control and there's a teacher or professor in front of a group, I think people are very compliant with masking. And I think they stick with kind of the social distancing, the hand washing rules that we've been talking about for months now.
You have someone there, basically.
Definitely. And especially like in elementary school, my kids are great at keeping their masks on. But once they, you know, walk off that school property, you start seeing the gathering of kids, playgrounds, carpooling, sporting events. All of that contributes to the spread.
So what do you foresee in the coming days, weeks, months, as far as what Lubbock will need to get a hold on this surge?
Really need the community to be mindful and really step back and really limit interactions with people outside your family group. Big concerns about upcoming holidays and people wanting to get together. And we just have to accept that, you know, this fall's going to look different and it's not going to meet kind of what our expectations are for holidays and gatherings. And, you know, we really need to get back to the basics of wearing masks, hand washing, you know, watching your distance and really limiting those interactions with others.
Catherine Wells is the City of Lubbock's Public Health Director. Catherine, thanks again for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Let's turn now and take a broader look at what the numbers tell us about the COVID spike in Texas. Jordan Rubio is a data journalist with the Houston Chronicle, and he's been parsing through these numbers with a group of Chronicle reporters. Jordan, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We talked about how we have reached and surpassed that 1 millionth case number in Texas. Is this 1 million cases overall? We're not talking about current active cases, but a cumulative number?
Yeah, yes. So this is 1 million cases since the start of the pandemic here in Texas in March.
18,700 deaths when I last checked. It's hard to even grasp that. To be honest, is there a way of comparing that with what other states or other places have experienced?
Sure. So at the Chronicle, we do kind of our own counts every day. And so what we're seeing from deaths is about 19,000, more than 19,000, which in terms of total deaths puts us second in the nation behind only New York, which we all remember watching on the news early on with morgues outside and trucks to put in people who've died from the virus. So it's been a pretty, the death toll has been pretty bad here.
We were just on the line with the health director of Lubbock. That's clearly a hot spot. Where are you, as you look at the map, where are you seeing some of the highest number of cases, numbers of cases across the state?
Oh, obviously, you mentioned Lubbock, and the panhandle has been hit very hard, but El Paso is currently where the bulk of the cases and the hospitalizations are happening. You know, there are something like 6,779 hospitalizations last I checked. You know, more than 1,000 of them are in El Paso.
What about Houston and Dallas? What are you seeing in some of the other major cities?
So in Houston, you know, hospitalizations are rising, but they're not to the point where it should be any kind of concern. But the caseloads are definitely getting a lot higher here. El Paso has been hit the hardest in terms of total cases, but Dallas and Tarrant counties are second and third, and Houston isn't far behind. So we're definitely seeing a spike in cases here in Houston and in DFW, but right now hospitalizations are not surging to the point where it looks like health systems are going to be overwhelmed.
In a sense, it's not enough to know the raw numbers, right? You have to know what they add up to. Is there any way of determining how we got here exactly, especially when you consider the numbers of cases in California, another highly populated state, mm-hmm. but also New York, of course. How did Texas get where it is right now.
All right. So talking with health experts like Dr. Peter Hotez or infectious disease epidemiologists like Catherine Choisi, what they're saying is basically, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, if you remember, is that Texas actually wasn't affected as much as you saw in New York or California or Washington State. But because we had the 2-week lockdown, and what they're saying is that we didn't stay locked down long enough, that the state reopened too fast. And then, you know, we saw that the state reopened early. It hadn't met all the metrics that it, you know, set out to before reopening. And then cases started to spike really highly in, you know, June, July, August, before coming down. So it's really that the state reopened and it's kind of stayed open. And then we're seeing the spikes, whereas other states, you know, locked down and they took steps to mitigate the spread of the disease, which we haven't seen as much in Texas.
What is the prognosis for the next couple of months? Is there any way of tracking a trajectory here?
I personally don't know. I can't quantify any sort of trajectory, but I think the best way to put it is in the words of Dr. Hotez, which is maybe the worst is yet to come.
Jordan Rubio is data journalist with the Houston Chronicle. He and a team of Chronicle reporters have been looking into how Texas became the first state in the U.S. to have more than a million COVID-19 cases. We'll link to their latest over at texasstandard.org. Jordan, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
In for Wells Dunbar on this Thursday, the Standard's Michael Marks monitoring the talk of Texas on social media. Hi there, Michael. What are you reading?
Hey, David. Conversation on social media related to the continued upswing of COVID-19 cases in Texas, particularly as we just heard in hotspots in places like Lubbock and El Paso. Wanted to share this tweet from Lauren Villagran. She's an El Paso Times reporter who we've had on the program. She tweeted this morning that I'm writing about frontline health workers in El Paso for the El Paso Times. The story's taken 6 days. Every day I update the death toll in the fifth paragraph. I started at 657. Today it's 725. 68 people have died in the time it took to write this story. That's just in El Paso. Also in El Paso, David, Twitter user Labor of Loeb writes, "There's so little help to be found. This is heartbreaking but scary at the same time. The country wasn't well equipped to take care of people anyway, but right now we're just going to hell in a handbasket. I live in El Paso, Texas. We're on the national news every night due to COVID." So definitely thinking about those folks, hoping that they are wearing their masks.
Indeed. We would love to hear from you, Texas. You know what to do. Look for us on social media. Michael Marks is monitoring social media on this Thursday, and he'd love to hear from you. He'll be back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU. Stories of Horned Frog changemakers like Amiso George, who is helping organizations navigate COVID-19 crisis communications, can be found at tcu.edu/teamwork.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. When voters in Harris County went to the polls last week, they used machines that hadn't been upgraded in 20 years. The county is currently the largest in the country to use electronic machines that don't create a paper record for ballots, though many see this as a problem. The county spent more than a year looking for a replacement. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider picks up the paper trail.
Back in July of 2019, then Harris County Clerk Diane Troutman spoke to a trade show put on by the voting equipment industry. Troutman told them that while Harris County had budgeted $74 million to upgrade its voting machines, it would take a year before it could select a vendor. And even then, the new machines wouldn't be ready until after the 2020 election.
Actually, just to make 5,000 machines will take months. So to get them back, put them in the field, teach the election workers and the voters how to use them, you are looking at, our estimate is, the May 2021 election before they can be used.
Those plans were on track right up until March, when the first cases of coronavirus appeared in Greater Houston.
COVID obviously threw all of the county's election plans for a loop.
That's Dan Wallach. He's an expert on voting security at Rice University's Computer Science Department. He says that Troutman's resignation in the face of the pandemic, for health reasons, set the process back.
Chris Hollins, her replacement, had a lot on his plate besides dealing with new voting machines. He had to deal with radically increasing the size of our vote-by-mail infrastructure, creating drive-through voting.
Hollins took office with the intent of serving only until his replacement could be elected. He steps down next week as a new appointed administrator, Isabel Longoria, will take up managing the county's elections. So where do things stand with the selection of a new voting machine system?
One of my final actions in office will be sending a recommendation over to our county attorney's office, which around the time of December or so will make it to commissioner's court for a vote.
Hollins told Houston Matters he hadn't made his selection yet, but that he'll be making a recommendation this week.
We will be taking on a paper-based system. You'll use a touchscreen, sort of like an iPad, to make your selection. And then that will be printed out on a sheet of paper that will be put into a machine. And so we will be able to, in a paper-based manner, go back and audit every single election if there are ever any questions.
Hollins said poll workers will have to be trained on the use of the new machines, but for voters, he doesn't expect any problems.
Regardless of the machine that we choose, I imagine that it will be more intuitive for voters than what we currently have, and I think Harris County residents will pick up quickly.
And Hollins said the machines will all be in place and ready to use by the May 2021 municipal elections as scheduled. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with Texans who are working safe and keeping communities strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. As Ken Herman of the Austin American-Statesman writes, she got more votes than Donald Trump, more than either of the two presidents with the last name of Bush. Indeed, more Texans voted for her than Ronald Reagan. She now holds the distinction of having won more votes in Texas than any other elected official. And the greatest vote-getter in Texas history is none other than, drumroll please, Jane Bland. In this general election, Jane Bland became the first statewide candidate to top the 6 million votes mark in Texas history. Now, if you're asking, Jane who? This may say something about just how little most folks know about how judges are picked for the highest court in Texas, or to be more precise and perhaps drive home the point, the two highest courts of last resort in Texas. You knew we have two high courts, right? Randall Urban is a UT law professor and member of the Texas Ethics Commission. Welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin by talking about, just for a moment, about Jane Bland and how she got where she got. She was not first placed on the Texas Supreme Court by voters. It was a governor who put her there, right?
That's correct. Governor Abbott appointed her to the Supreme Court recently. In Texas, we have elected our Supreme Court judges since 1891. And that's in the Texas Constitution. And also the Constitution provides that the governor appoints vacancies to the Supreme Court when one arises. Seven of the current Supreme Court justices were originally appointed to the court and weren't originally elected. And this includes four now that Governor Abbott has appointed to the Supreme Court.
So there's a, as I understand it, something of a dance that takes place when one of the justices wants to leave that court. They will, instead of waiting until their term is up, resign and then give what, the governor the authority to replace that person?
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, the Supreme Court is a ripe ground for appointments to the federal bench. I mean, two of the people that left the Supreme Court recently got appointed to the federal bench. So when that occurs, the governor has the authority to appoint people to the Supreme Court. And usually what the governor will do is appoint people who have served as state judges, either in the Court of Appeals or the District Court, to those benches because he or she, whoever the governor is, prefers an experienced hand to go on the Supreme Court, not somebody just brand new.
Given, though, that Texas does something that the U.S. Constitution doesn't call for, and that is the election, public election of justices, does this amount to a sort of constitutional sidestepping, or do you see it that way?
I don't. You know, we have resignations all the time from the legislature and from other offices, and so it's nothing unusual. What's unusual about this is there has been a law passed in 2019, and the governor signed it, creating a bipartisan commission to review judicial selection in Texas. It's a 15-person commission, and they're tasked to provide a report to the legislature by the end of this year. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see if that bipartisan commission comes up with any novel suggestions about changing the way we select our judges in Texas.
Well, now, there has been some talk about something called the Missouri Plan. Are you familiar with that?
Well, the Missouri Plan is essentially a system where the governor is presented a list of names by a blue ribbon commission, and the governor appoints somebody from that list to the bench, and then they don't run for re-election per se in a partisan election. What they do is they run for a retention election. So it's just an up or down vote on whether Judge X remains in office.
And would that effectively remove politics from the process, do you think, or no?
Well, I don't think you can ever remove politics from the process. The problem with approval of any plan is that you have to go through a political process. You know, the legislature, you know, we have 83 Republicans and 67 Democrats. I mean, they have to come to some consensus on whether this system works, because in order to amend the Constitution, they need two-thirds vote. So you're going to need a bipartisan supermajority in order to get any change to the Constitution in the way we select our judges. The other problem you have is we are not in a normal legislative session. We have the pandemic. We have the state budget crisis that's been caused by the economic damage that the pandemic has caused. And so those two items are going to be front and center when the legislature convenes in January of 2021. And other issues like judicial reform, which in another year might have some wind behind it, are going to be less important than, you know, the pressing issues of the pandemic and the state budget crisis.
Randall Urban is a UT law professor and a member of the Texas Ethics Commission. Professor Urban, thanks so much for explaining the vicissitudes of picking judges in the Lone Star State. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate it.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Daily COVID-19 cases in Texas are back up to levels not seen since the state's initial peak in July. The Texas Department of State Health Services on Wednesday reported more than 10,000 new coronavirus cases for a second day in a row. The statewide death toll also rose by 141 yesterday to 19,004. The rate of COVID-19 patients in El Paso's trauma service area remains above 40% of all hospitalizations. In response, El Paso County has extended its emergency shutdown, including a curfew and stay-at-home order until December 1st. County Judge Ricardo Samaniego says he expects the county will request additional mobile morgues once the six on hand reach capacity. He's not planning to ease restrictions until coronavirus hospitalizations fall below 25%.
As our hospitals continue to be overwhelmed, every day that the county's order remains in effect is another day that we can save lives. It is another day that we can provide at least some relief to our health care workers who are extremely exhausted.
Later today, a state appeals court is expected to rule on the legality of El Paso County's emergency order. The Speaker of the Texas House is telling the state's Republican Party Chairman Alan West to go back to Florida. Representative Dennis Bonin is among many top Republicans who've split with the former Florida congressman over who will lead the lower chamber in the next legislative session when Bonin steps down. Speaking to KFYO News Radio on Tuesday, Bonin criticized West's efforts to undermine Republican leadership.
We need to have a fund for Alan West to be bought a one-way bus ticket back to Florida. The problem is I don't think Florida will take him. Alan West is so off base and so out of line and so irresponsible, it is infuriating.
Earlier this week, West declared Beaumont Representative Dade Phelan a political traitor for working with Democrats in the last legislative session and seeking their support for the Speaker's gavel. Phelan says he has enough bipartisan support to be Speaker next session. And the U.S. Labor Department reports this morning roughly 32,000 Texans filed for unemployment benefits last week. That's about 5,000 fewer than the week before and the lowest number of claims since the start of the pandemic. According to the Texas Workforce Commission, more than 1.4 million people in the state are currently receiving jobless benefits. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with Texans who are working safe and keeping communities strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In the days since the general election, the app for the social media network Parlay, or Parler, depending on how you choose to pronounce it, has risen to the top of the charts on the app stores for both Apple and Google. Some call Parler a Twitter for conservatives, and many who've signed up say they're tired of content restrictions on Twitter and Facebook they feel stifle conservative views. Prominent voices on the right, including Texas Senator Ted Cruz and Fox personality Laura Ingraham, have also found a home on Parler. Our tech expert Omar Gayaga is here to tell us more. Welcome back, Omar.
Hey, David. How's it going?
It's going pretty well. I think a lot of people, though, are stumbling, especially in the news business, stumbling over exactly how to pronounce this. Its founders from Denver, Colorado, back, 2 years ago, called it Parlay, but that's not how a lot of others are saying it these days.
Yeah, I think people are like, get that French nonsense out of here. We're going to call it Parler, and that's what it is. I think the users have kind of overtaken that.
Taken it over.
Pronouncing it that way. But it's doing incredibly well. I mean, it launched in 2018, but post-election, it's having a huge surge of users. It went from about 4.5 million users a week ago to about 8 million, and it's just exploding in growth. It's the number one free app in the App Store and is really, really attracting a lot of influencers on the conservative side.
On the conservative side, why are conservatives seemingly flocking to this platform?
Well, some of it has to do with dissatisfaction with Twitter and Facebook's rules, how they've begun to label posts from President Donald Trump, and that they've been they feel that they're being targeted for right-wing views. There's Parler, and then there's two other apps, MeWe and Gab, that have sort of become kind of gathering spots for conservatives who maybe want to stay on Twitter and Facebook, but also want another platform where they can say pretty much whatever they want with much different rules.
Just to be clear, this wasn't, or was it, crafted as a sort of conservative safe space, if that's not mixing metaphors too much?
It is, but Parler does have its own set of rules. I mean, they say you can't post anything to do with terrorism, no spam, unsolicited ads, pornography, blackmail. It's not that it's a lawless place with no rules, but some people that have gotten on the platform specifically to tease conservatives or to mess with conservatives have found themselves booted anyway. So there are definitely some rules in place. But conservatives seem to feel that they've got more leeway there, that they're not going to be labeled the way Twitter and Facebook has been doing with posts that have misinformation.
Well, now, besides Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who are some other fairly well-known Parler early adopters?
When I actually signed up for the app just to see what it's like. And
so Omar Gayaga is an early adopter here with Parler, or no, you just wanted to check out things?
Hit me up on Parlay, guys. But the first thing I see when I get on this after the terms of service is, here's who we want you to follow. It's Ted Cruz, Sean Hannity, Mark Levin, Devin Nunes, Dinesh D'Souza, Diamond and Silk. I mean, that's the first thing you see when you get on the app. So it's definitely, steering you toward following these influencers who are, big names in the conservative world. And over the weekend, we saw this app explode in activity with people like Laura Loomer, who was banned from Facebook a year ago, telling people, get on Parler. That's where we're going to meet. Everybody, meet us there.
So I know Twitter had some growing pains early on. What about Parler?
Yeah, and it's been ongoing. I mean, ever since they started in 2018, I mean, there have been some notable conservatives that joined even back then. I mean, Candace Owens was on very, very early on. Ted Cruz, Brad Parscale, Utah Senator Mike Lee. I mean, they're not all just joining now. They were there for a while. And along the way, they've had a lot of, server issues. There was one instance where 200,000 accounts from Saudi Arabia joined the platform and brought it down. it's just a scaling issue, like when Twitter first started. And I mean, I imagine with this surge of users and money coming in, they're going to want to expand very quickly and do a lot of hiring.
Well, now you mentioned money coming in. How do they make money?
Well, they have said that they are going to be an ad revenue model the way Twitter is, but rather than an ad service the way Twitter and Facebook do it, they plan to set up a system where advertisers can target influencers directly, so that it would be more of cash going directly to these big names that are on the platform rather than through a centralized service.
Do you think platforms like Facebook and Twitter might be concerned about losing their conservative users to Parler?
Well, it's always something worrisome if you lose a mass number of users at one time, but that's never really happened. We always hear every few years people are going to leave Facebook and there's this new alternative that pops up and then it goes away. So I don't know that these will last, but I think what's also happening is people are playing multiple platforms. A lot of the conservatives aren't leaving Twitter or Facebook. They're just adding Parler and maybe copy-pasting over the same kinds of posts for a different audience that's there that may not be on Twitter or Facebook.
Omar Gayaga follows the tech news over at TechMinuteTexas.com, and you can keep up with him over there. Omar, thanks so much for joining us again on The Standard.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
He was a Texas sharecropper's son and a World War II hero. Why haven't more people heard the name Doris Miller? We'll talk about that next as The Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at TexasCollegeSavings.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In the U.S. Navy, most aircraft carriers are named for presidents, but recently the Navy announced that a new supercarrier will break with that tradition. Instead of bearing the name Bush or Kennedy or Washington, the ship will be called the USS Doris Miller. Miller was the son of sharecroppers from Waco. He joined the Navy in 1939 and served as a cook, just like most African-American sailors at that time. But on December 7, 1941, he found himself in the thick of combat. Miller was assigned to the USS West Virginia, stationed at Pearl Harbor. When Japanese forces ambushed the base, Miller rushed to an anti-aircraft gun he'd never been trained to use and fired back at the attacking Japanese Zeros all the same. When the attack subsided, Miller carried his injured crewmates to safety, saving them from the oil and water that was inundating the West Virginia. The ripple effects of Miller's actions didn't stop at Pearl Harbor, however. Joining us now to tell us more, Michael Parrish, history professor at Baylor University and co-author of Doris Miller, Pearl Harbor and the Birth of the Civil Rights Movement. Professor Parrish, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
First, tell us a little bit more about what being in the Navy was like for black sailors like Miller in the late 30s and early 40s.
Well, it was a terrible experience for people of color, particularly African Americans. They were forced into the worst kinds of duties and very often abused and certainly taken for granted by white naval personnel, including the officers that they served and worked for in very menial positions. Miller suffered the effects of the Great Depression. He wasn't a very good student in school, although he was a great athlete. And he joined the Navy to try to help his parents just survive and send a little money home. However, he quickly began to realize that his opportunities were very limited and that he would have to suffer through and endure a difficult experience in the Navy.
But then on that fateful day, December 7th, 1941, he took hold of that gun. He did not have any training?
No, he didn't have any training on the Browning 50 caliber anti-aircraft machine gun, but he was an expert marksman. He had grown up in a rural area and frequently went out into the woods with his brothers and his father and knew how to use a rifle. So he had great confidence in his ability to fire the anti-aircraft machine gun. He, I think more importantly, was one of the last men to leave the ship. That's because he was helping save drowning, suffering sailors who were in the water, and he was helping pull them aboard and making sure that they were safe. And then he swam across the harbor with several others under fire the entire time. So he was very, very lucky to survive the attack, and that he received great publicity eventually, despite the resistance of the Navy, and became an icon of the civil rights movement.
In fact, you write that the Navy was reluctant at first to recognize Miller, and he went unnamed in initial newspaper reports. What changed to bring him the recognition that he'd earned?
Yeah, the African-American press was in a golden era at that time, the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, and on into the 50s. There were several very prominent newspapers, including the Pittsburgh Courier, which took up the cause of placing pressure on the Navy Department, using its political connections with white politicians who depended to a significant degree on the black vote in the North. And then eventually Franklin Roosevelt made the final decision to have Miller awarded the Navy Cross. He received the award from fellow Texan Admiral Chester Nimitz. Nimitz, before the war, had been reluctant to support raising African-American sailors above the level of messmen and stewards and cooks. But as a result of Doris Miller's great heroism, he became an enthusiastic supporter of allowing, encouraging, and in fact ordering African Americans to receive distinctions like the Navy Cross and to be allowed to rise to greater responsibilities and ranks in the Navy.
How did Miller himself feel about the attention he started to receive?
Yeah, he was a reluctant hero. He was relatively shy, although he had great confidence in his ability. He didn't seek publicity at all. He was no gung-ho civil rights activist, although by the end of his experience, he said that he hoped that he had helped the cause of civil rights a little, and that he was determined to do his part after the war to advance the cause of civil rights. The black newspapers began to pressure the Navy Department to, as they put it, bring Dory home, so that he could go on a tour like other celebrities at the time and other war heroes at the time, helping recruit and also helping raise money for war bonds. And finally, the Navy relented and agreed to send him home on a tour. And he gave speeches insisting that the country pull together and that everyone do their part for the cause of what the African-American press called the Double V campaign, victory abroad over Nazi and Japanese tyranny, but also victory at home for the cause of civil rights.
Miller's presumed to have died in 1943, I believe it was, when his ship was hit by a Japanese submarine in the South Pacific, and I understand his body was never found. 3 years later, the Navy issued an order to desegregate. What role do you think Miller's legacy played in that decision and later in the civil rights movement in the decades that followed?
Yeah, he was killed on board the Liscum Bay, a small aircraft carrier. It was a horrendous catastrophe for the Navy. Over 900 sailors were on board and over 600 were killed by one Japanese submarine. He had a major impact on sustaining the civil rights movement after World War II. Every civil rights leader, every advocate of desegregating the Navy and, in fact, desegregating the entire military, every one of those leaders would mention Doris Miller's name. Like many other icons of the civil rights movement, Doris Miller has received a lot of attention, but here lately, it's really, really fitting and I think monumental that the aircraft carrier is being named for him. Secretary Maudley, the acting Secretary of the Navy, who made the decision, consulted with several retired black naval admirals for advice on the name of the new aircraft carrier. You wanted to name it for an African-American, and if possible, name it for an African-American sailor. And the admirals came back immediately and said that it has to be Doris Miller.
Michael Parrish is a history professor at Baylor University and co-author of Doris Miller, Pearl Harbor and the Birth of the Civil Rights Movement. Professor Parrish, thanks so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Ever since university and college classrooms reopened to students and faculty in the fall, administrators across Texas have put in place online tools for reporting, tracking, and visualizing COVID-19 cases. While the caliber of information varies, one college stands out because it refuses to publicly divulge any of its info. From KERA North Texas, Bill Zeebel reports.
They're called COVID dashboards, and among Texas colleges, they're common. They show the total active cases among students, staff, and faculty, with updates listed weekly, some even daily. A few include recoveries. Dashboards exist across Texas school systems, from independent school districts like Dallas, where they're required by the state, to the University of Dallas. But not for Collin College.
There's no central place for those numbers, and those numbers are not being shared with faculty, the staff, any employees, or the public.
Audra Heslip has been a faculty member at Collin College for 8 years.
I asked, could the college please make the numbers available at the very least to the employees? Because the majority of employees, faculty and staff, are required to go to campus. And no one has any idea if the college is a hotspot. Nobody has any idea if maybe there's one case or maybe there's 20 or 200.
As a result, Heslip and her colleagues, such as adjunct faculty member Benjamin Moreau, fear the worst.
I feel like if the numbers were super low, that would be something to tout. They're not, so it makes me think it's bad.
KERA reached out to Collin College administrators for answers, but no one responded. Compared to campuses in the University of North Texas System or SMU who publish online COVID dashboards, Collin College looks like the outlier. But Sarah Van Orman says it may not be. She's the past president of the American College Health Association and helped write COVID-19 guidelines for colleges and universities.
We know that most larger universities who have on-campus health services are maintaining a dashboard. We know that many institutions that don't necessarily have a health service, they may not have a dashboard.
And Collin College has no student health service, so it's not a surprise they don't have a dashboard. What's also common at two-year schools, says Van Orman, students don't live on campus because they commute, and that all makes tracking students difficult. But Collin College does have dorms, and the school has encouraged in-person learning. So when Professor Heslip requested a COVID dashboard with support from dozens of her colleagues, she says she got this reply from Vice President Tony Jenkins.
It was an exact quotation from this administrator. One of the times when we asked for those numbers, she said, "What's in it for us?" It seemed like the wrong priority.
While Collin College is not disclosing or releasing the number of positive cases or patterns that pose a risk, it is reporting that information to the Department of State Health Services. And the State Health Department isn't obligated to inform the college community. When a colleague of Benjamin Moreau tested positive for the coronavirus, the adjunct professor did not hear it from the school. He didn't hear it from the state.
None of us were officially informed. She informed us. I do not believe that they closed the library, which is where her office space was. The two employees that she worked with quarantined for 2 weeks and got testing on their own.
Miro says, fortunately, they did not test positive for COVID. Like them, he says, along with colleagues who are afraid to talk, he takes extra care these days and gathers as much information as possible to avoid infections. I'm Bill Zeebel.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is our social media editor, but Michael Marks is filling in for him today. Welcome back, Michael.
Thanks, David. Wanted to bring you some of the comments and reaction relating to that interview we heard earlier in the show about Doris Miller, the sailor from Waco who exhibited such heroism at Pearl Harbor. One thing I wanted to mention first that we had to leave out of the interview for time, you know, Miller did receive the Navy Cross for his actions at Pearl Harbor, but not the Congressional Medal of Honor. Mm-hmm. Our guest, Professor Michael Parrish from Baylor, he told us that, you know, over a dozen sailors at Pearl Harbor did receive the Medal of Honor. All of them were white. And their actions were, by the metrics Professor Paris used, at least no more deserving of the medal than were Doris Miller's. In fact, there remains a movement to have Miller posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor. Look no further than this tweet by Robert Hart, who says, "Dory Miller is a World War II hero who acted above and beyond the call of duty during the attack on Pearl Harbor. The U.S. Navy is right to name its latest aircraft carrier in his honor. He also deserves to receive the Medal of Honor." Also this from Richard Stubbe. Sorry if I mispronounced your last name, Richard. He tweets at us, "From what I've read, Miller is the very definition of a hero." And this from John McFarlane on Miller being the namesake for the Navy's next aircraft carrier. "So glad to see Dory Miller get some small honor for his heroism. His story was part of a reading unit in my third grade class, and I will never forget the mixed feeling of injustice for and admiration of this hero. We can't right these wrongs, but we can recognize them." So lots of folks affected by it, by that story that, you know, Frank, just speaking for myself as somebody who grew up in Texas, I had never heard until I was an adult. And I think that's the case for a lot of folks.
Tell the story. Tell the story. Share the story. It's a remarkable story. Doris Miller and a super carrier, one of those extra large aircraft carriers, will soon be named in his honor. It's remarkable that he did not get the Congressional Medal of Honor, and it's one of the tragedies, frankly, in this story. It's a remarkable story.
David, we also had that conversation with Omar Gayaga on Parlay or Parlor?
Parlay.
Would you like the definitive ruling on the pronunciation?
Well, I guess so, yeah. Well, I know that the founders said it was Parlay, and of course it's from the French to speak. But so hit me with it.
All right. So, well, it's interesting you bring up the founders. The person you're about to hear speak is John Mates, the company's CEO. Here he is last week on Good Morning San Diego.
"We have people. People have conversations on Parlor. They share information."
Did you hear me? It was kind of hard to hear.
Yeah, he sort of glided right over it. Did he say Parlor?
Here it is again.
"Twitter has users. We have people. People have conversations on Parlor. They share."
Parlor. No Parler. Question, to the chagrin of all French teachers out there, Parler appears to be the winner. I asked on Twitter whether any of our listeners are on Parler. Perhaps not surprisingly, since we asked on Twitter, most said no. Sometimes no accompanied by some words we can't say on the radio. Some said they joined just to see what folks over there were talking about, but I don't believe that the pronunciation is going to be the most controversial element of this particular social media platform in the days to come.
Something tells me that you are right, Michael. Michael Marks is the Texas Standard Zone filling in for Wells Dunbar. You can keep up with the news 24/7 over at texasstandard.org. And as always, we'd love to hear what's making news in your part of Texas. We're going to be back here tomorrow, and we hope you will join us. Till then, visit us over at texasstandard.org.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.